Okay, I think we're going to make a start before we begin. Just a couple of things before we start today. Just first of all, once again, I just wanted to thank everyone for all the good wishes and the emails and the calls. It was really very, very supportive and very encouraging, and thank you very much. Some people asked me, I put an email yesterday, but I just wanted to mention it again. Some people asked me if we're having any service here in Sydney. We are going to be having it at the end of the 30 days, which is the Shloshim. That's Tuesday night, the 30th of June at 7:30. Two doors down at the Shtibel at 49 Bellevue Road. If anyone can make it, it's a short memorial service with the Chaim afterwards. 7:30 in the evening. Tuesday, the 30th of June. I think by now I've managed to confuse everyone about when the Shi'urim are on or off. So just to confuse you a bit more, originally I was going to actually finish the series today, because next week I'm going to actually be away next Thursday in Melbourne. But because we missed a few weeks, what I'm going to do is I'm going to do one today and one more in 2 weeks' time. That'll be the end of the series. Then we're going to break for a few weeks for the school holidays. It so happens that the first Thursday of next term is the 9th of Av, which is a Tisha B'Av, which obviously won't have a class. So the new series then will start on the 6th of August. So we want today, one in 2 weeks' time, the 2nd of July, and then the 6th of August. Okay, so what I want to do today is continue on the topic which we began. The topic of Venus, Mars, or Sinai, understanding the components between men and women, and take an important topic in human development which is linked to this whole idea. In the first few weeks that we spent together on the topic, we developed a theme that the world is made up of male and female forces. And we discussed that originally, Kabbalistically, we learned that when the world was created, it began with a force, a single force that was a combination of both male and female. And by divine design, it was then split into two separate components, two separate forces, with the aim and the goal of it becoming one eventually. And the idea that we developed is that every person has a dominant force. So generally, men are dominated by the male component, women are by the female. It's not always that way. Sometimes it's a bit blurry, bit more blurry than that. But the more important idea is that everyone needs to access both. That's the idea. Everyone needs to learn to access both components, both the male and female. And we developed this on many levels: language, communication, personal development, etc. Now, before we go on to today's topic, just to refresh ourselves on the definition. The two definitions that we developed, the concept of the defining the male force and the female force. And we explained that the male force is the power and the ability to create infinite amount of potential. Right? So the male idea is to create newness, something new all the time, something new, a spark of potential, which then remains in the world of potential and doesn't go anywhere. So it's created very quickly, very aggressively, very forcefully, but then can disappear as fast as it actually was created, right? That's the male component, to always create something new, to move from somewhere, from here to somewhere else. Whereas the female component, the female force, is that ability to stay where you are and to nurture and to internalize and to process and to develop that potential into something new, into something of a creation. So those are the two definitions that we developed over the few weeks when we discussed this idea. So today what I want to do is deal with two critical components of human behavior which come out of these two definitions. And that is the two ideas, and we'll see how they relate to each other, the concept of ambition on the one hand and humility. and they are two very, very important forces, the one primarily male, the other primarily female, which must learn to work with each other. They have to be both present within a healthy human being to develop properly. Now, just to give a little bit of introduction to this idea, many of you would remember that a while ago we discussed the seven emotions of the human development of the soul. And in discussing those seven emotions, we developed the idea that the emotional makeup of a person is divided into two triangles. I don't know if you remember that. The two, top triangle and the bottom triangle. The top triangle were the primary emotional forces of the soul of the human being. The bottom triangle was the strengths that we have, the abilities that we have to implement and to carry forward the responses from the primary emotions. So, just to summarize, the top triangle was chesed on the right and gevurah on the left, and then tiferet in the middle. And the chesed and the gevurah, chesed was the right emotional force of the power to give, the power to attract, the power to be flexible, the power to share with others, the power of love, all those, that whole range of emotions that fit into that one idea, the chesed. The left was the idea of gevura. Gevura was the concept of restraint, of discipline, of judgment, of aggression, of rejection, of withdrawal, etc. And then the middle one, tiferet, was the idea of synthesis, of synthesizing both together and creating like an harmonious sort of existence. But that's the expression of raw emotion. In other words, that's what governs our main emotional responses to all situations. But then we have the second triangle. And the two forces in the second triangle, the two main forces of the second triangle, are two things which we call netzach and hod. And that's what we're going to deal with today, really. Netzach is on the right, hod is on the left. Netzach is the concept of overcoming obstacles, the idea of ambition, the idea of moving forward. In other words, sometimes a person can have, let's say, a person can have an expression of love, or a desire to do kindness, or a desire for discipline, whichever, chesed or gevurah. And a person can have a very strong feeling of love or discipline or fear or whatever the case is, but doesn't have the wherewithal, doesn't have the ability to actually carry it through, doesn't have the ability to develop it and nurture it in the face of obstacles, of challenges. Right? So therefore, what God built into our emotional makeup is this concept called netzach. Netzach, actually the translation of the word netzach is victory. The idea of winning, the idea of we can do it. In other words, the idea of being ambitious to say we can overcome an obstacle, we can move forward, we can make it happen, we can overcome challenges, we can overcome obstacles, we can achieve, we can reach tremendous heights, we can move forward, we can get there. Right? That's the idea of netzach. But at the same time, to counterbalance that concept of netzach, and we'll see soon why it's so important to balance it out, we have the idea of hod. Hod is the idea of humility. Humility in the sense that sometimes we need to learn to hold back. Not always do we have to overcome an obstacle. Sometimes we have to accept the situation the way it is, and we have to maybe give room for someone else to do it. We have to hold back. It's sort of the counterpart of hod. And today we're going to deal with these two tools, the tool of netzach and the tool of hod, and see how they're so important, how they both have to work together within the human development. Now, essentially, these two emotions of netzach and hod originate in the male and female force. Because, as we said before, the male idea is to create something new. Right? The male ability or the male drive is always to have a newness, and always to discover new potential. And therefore, an outcome of that is the concept of netzach. An outcome of that is the concept of ambition. Of never to be put off by an obstacle, never to be put off by something standing in the way, because we've always got to discover something new. We cannot remain where we are. Always, sometimes, I mean, in a negative way, it's sometimes linked to ego, which we'll soon talk about. And it can be very egocentric, because it's always about becoming better, always becoming showing that we're better and proving that we're better, etc., etc. Right? So, in its raw state, that concept of ambition, of always moving forward, of always creating something new, of overcoming a challenge, of always moving ahead, that's the male force within the person. That's the concept of Netzach. But we're going to discuss soon how that can be very detrimental also, that can be disastrous if it's not trained and if it's not balanced properly. And therefore the balance of the Netzach is the female force called Hod, which is the idea of humility, the idea of accepting a situation the way it is sometimes. Hod, it's called Hod.
You said the idea of...
humility.
Humility.
Yeah, yeah, right. And humility in a sense, we'll develop this soon in a moment, but the concept of nurturing where we are now, not moving to something else, but accepting and developing and nurturing the present, the situation where we are now, which is the female idea, if you remember correctly, of not creating something new, but developing and nurturing what we have now. And therefore not always feeling the need to move forward. Not always the need to conquer someone else's space, but to remain where we are. So that's these two ideas, the Netzach and the Hod, ambition and humility, is the male and female interplay between these two very, very important emotions. So let's try and develop this idea. Let's talk about ambition first and understand how ambition is so important, if it's healthy. We know that, and we've spoken about it so many times, that critical to human development is the idea of change, right? The idea that a human being can change, can create something new. That's what sets us apart from the rest of the world, the rest of existence. That critical to human development is this idea, the contribution to the development of the whole creation by becoming a partner, so to speak, with God in creation, in creating always something new, of changing ourselves, changing the world, changing society, improving, creating something new, discovering new potential. Because we know, and we've discussed this many times, that God created an imperfect world by design. An imperfect world. Why? Because He left it to us to become the second partner. He wanted us to improve in that world, to create new things and to become a participant and contribute to the creation of the universe. And therefore, God implanted and embedded in the creation infinite potential for us to grow into, for us to discover. And the human being's potential, the potential of the human being, is infinite on one level. And that's part of our problem. Very, very often we underestimate the potential of the human being. We underestimate our own ability. We underestimate the levels and the heights which we could actually reach if we try. Which explains a very interesting saying of our sages in the Talmud. In the Talmud it says that a person should always say, when will my actions reach those of our patriarchs Abraham, Isaac and Jacob? Now that's a very, very bold statement. Why should we compare ourselves to Abraham, Isaac and Jacob? They were great people. They were great holy individuals, people who are infinitely greater than ourselves. And yet, we are taught to be so ambitious on one level, where the Talmud says that a person should actually aim for the top. We've got to be able to say, when will my deeds reach those of Abraham, Isaac and Jacob? Very, very brave and very ambitious statement. Right. We might have spoken about this before, but there's a fascinating passage in Pirkei Avot, the Ethics of the Fathers. And it talks about the destructive traits that can destroy a human being. And one of the famous passages it says is that jealousy, lust, and pursuit of glory destroy a human being. Kina, taiva, kovod. Jealousy, lust, and pursuit of glory. Those are the three things that can destroy a human being. That's what the Mishnah says. That's what the passage teaches us. Now there's a fascinating explanation from one of the great philosophers called the Maharal of Prague. And the Maharal of Prague says that actually, if you look at specifically those three things of jealousy, lust, and pursuit of glory, they're actually critical and fundamental to the development of a human being. They must exist. It just depends how. Let's take the idea of tava, lust, desire. A person who had no desire, if we had no lust, okay, lust doesn't have negative connotation, but if we had no desire, the word tava means to want. If we had no wants, we wouldn't get out of bed in the morning. We'd all be depressed human beings. We would just remain in bed. Yeah, you're right. You see? And nevertheless, people are still ambitious. I still came out of bed. I still came to learn. That's right. Because we do have a drive, you see. People couldn't operate. It's fundamental to the operation of the human being to have wants, to have desires. So that's what we need to see. We need to develop how that works, right? But essentially, it's not a bad thing. Nor is kinna, nor is jealousy, he says. Jealousy is healthy ambition. There has to be some level of healthy competition. There has to exist in the universe some level of comparison on a healthy level. Some benchmark to compare ourselves. Some goals where we can aspire to reach. In fact, in a spiritual way, we know the Talmud says that jealousy among the sages increases wisdom. Right? There's a saying like that in the Talmud. Kinnah suffering tarva chachma, jealousy among the way. There's good jealousy. Same going back what we said before, that a person should aspire to be like Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. That's a form of jealousy. You see something that's better than you, you aspire to that. And even pursuit of glory, the Maharal explains, is critically important, because a person has to have some healthy perception of oneself. A person has to preserve one's own dignity, one's own stature on a healthy level. And he has a lengthy essay where he explains, and he takes it all the way back to the beginning of the Chumash of Genesis, where he explains how really these three things are critical components of human development. Because a person cannot survive without some level of healthy ambition, which is linked to some level of healthy competition and healthy jealousy. There's a story in the Chumash called Pesach Sheni. Pesach Sheni is the second Pesach. What's the second Pesach? You know that in times of the Temple, one of the important components of the Pesach festival was the offering of the Paschal lamb, Korban Pesach. Today we don't have that, so because we don't have a temple, so today we have the shank bone and the seder plate to commemorate the Paschal lamb. But in olden times, in temple times, this was an important part of the Pesach celebration: matzah, bit of herbs, and the lamb, the Paschal lamb. It used to add a bit of flavor to the matzah in olden times. Nowadays we just have it on the table. We don't eat it, but right. This Paschal lamb, this mitzvah, was given to the Jewish people already in Egypt. In fact, the first Paschal lamb that the Jewish people brought was before they actually left Egypt. It was the night before the Exodus. In Egypt, they brought the first Korban Pesach, the first Paschal lamb, had the first Seder, they ate matzah, in preparation for the Exodus. But then, that was a unique one. Then the first one they actually brought as a free nation was a year later. What happened was, when they came out of Egypt, they came to the desert. They were then given, after the giving of the Torah, they were given the commandment to build a mishkan, to build a sanctuary. Part of the sanctuary was the altar. And on this altar, they brought sacrifices. And when the first Pesach came along, the Jews were able to celebrate the Pesach properly. And it says in the Torah that they brought the Paschal lamb, they brought the Korban Pesach. And this was considered an amazing idea. It was a symbol of freedom. It was a spiritual connection. The Korban Pesach represented all kinds of wonderful and deep ideas, and the Jews were able to do that on the first Pesach. And then the Torah continues to tell a story that there were a group of people who could not bring the Korban Pesach. Why could they not bring the Korban Pesach? Because they were impure. They had some involvement with the corpse or the dead body, and therefore they had contracted a spiritual impurity, as the law says. And the halacha is, the law is, that one who's impure, until there's a whole process of purification, one is impure, cannot actually bring the Paschal lamb, and therefore these few individuals got left out of the process. And they came running to Moses complaining. And they complained, why should we be left out of the process of bringing the Paschal Lamb? And the two words in Hebrew that they used is Lama Nigara. Why should we lose out? Everyone else is bringing the Korban Pesach and we not. Why should we miss that opportunity? Right. And Moses had to think about it and he says, well, you got a point, I have to consult. He says, hold on, and he prayed to God and he consulted to God and he had a revelation. And the revelation was the revelation of a new mitzvah. A new mitzvah called Pesach Sheni, the second Pesach. The second Pesach was that if anyone is in the position in the temple time who's had the circumstance where they're not able to bring the Korban Pesach, they're not able to bring the Pesach Lamb, they have a second chance a month later. Right? So because of these individuals, they actually, the Talmud says, we merited a new mitzvah in the Torah. The mitzvah called the second Pesach. Where did this all come from? It came from this feeling of, we cannot lose out. This feeling of, there's a challenge, there's a halachic obstacle, so to speak, there's got to be a way to fix this. There's got to be a way to overcome this. There's got to be a way to have this connection, have this mitzvah, notwithstanding the fact that we prevented from doing so. It was almost a jealousy thing. The whole nation is bringing the Korban Pesach and I can't do it. And it was considered a good thing. It was considered a praiseworthy concept. It wasn't considered jealousy, it was considered good. It was considered a very, very virtuous thing that they were worried about losing out on this mitzvah. And they wanted to do it. They wanted to have the opportunity like everyone else. Everyone else had this spiritual opportunity and they didn't have it. They felt robbed. And they came screaming to Moshe Rabbeinu and God gave them a second mitzvah. God responded and he gave them that second mitzvah. There was one of the Hasidic Rebbes called Rebbe Maharash said that everyone says, the world says, this is what he said, it works better in Yiddish, but he said that the Weltzach, the world says that if you encounter an obstacle, like you're traveling on the way and you encounter an obstacle, you should try go underneath it. If it doesn't work, you should jump over it. I say, he says, just jump over to begin with, like ignore the obstacle, like have that drive where obstacles don't matter, that you've got so obsessed with just moving forward that obstacles don't matter. Just move forward and have that attitude of we can do it and we can achieve and we can achieve those levels and those heights that the infinite potential of the human being gives us. You know, I don't know when it was, a year ago, 2 years ago, when that terrible tragedy happened in Merkaz HaRav Yeshiva in Jerusalem. So there was an amazing, amazing story of one of the young men that was killed in that thing. I don't know if you remember. I don't remember the details now. It was a while ago since I saw it. But it was one of them, one of the outstanding students that was actually killed in that tragedy was a Ethiopian, I think, who had come to the yeshiva, to the Merkaz HaRav Yeshiva, and he asked to be accepted in the Academy of Learning. He wanted to learn. He had this thirst for learning. But he clearly wasn't on the level. He clearly had no background and he clearly hadn't had the opportunity to learn as the others had, and he wasn't accepted. He was turned down because he didn't fit into the curriculum. He didn't fit into the requirements of the students that were part of that yeshiva. So he got himself a job in the yeshiva as a kitchen manager or something, or as a helper in the kitchen. And what he would do is, he was so determined, this guy, to study and to learn, that what he did was, he worked in the kitchen of the yeshiva, and every spare moment he would go into the study hall and find someone to teach him and take a piece of the Talmud or a piece of the Chumash, and he kept learning, and he was quite a bright fellow. And he slowly, slowly, with incredible determination, in between his jobs in the kitchen, he managed to master some of the curriculum, and he kept learning and learning until he felt within himself that he actually had mastered quite an unbelievable level. And one day he turned up at the table of the Rosh Hashiva, of one of the heads of the yeshiva, and said he'd want to apply for a test. He wants to get tested. And the guy looked at him and said, like, what do you mean? And he says, no, try me out. And he tested him, and this guy was amazed. Like, he in that amount of time, he'd actually managed to elevate himself to be on par, or even better than the yeshiva students. and he was immediately accepted in yeshiva, and unfortunately didn't have a nice ending because he was one of those students that were killed later. But it was just a story of incredible determination of a guy that thought, there's just no stopping me. In other words, I can do it. And that's an important part of the human development. It's an important part of growing, is to believe in ourselves, believe in our potential, believe that we can actually achieve, believe that we can overcome challenges and obstacles. And that is the ingredient, that's what makes us grow and change and reach new levels of human development. On the one hand. On the other hand, there's a tremendous danger with ambition. So we say, we've talked about the positives of ambition, but there's a tremendous danger of ambition. There's two dangers. One danger of ambition is that if it becomes ego-driven, which ambition lends itself to be very, very egocentric, then it can then be driven to such a level where it becomes a process that is detrimental to other people. In other words, we start to hurt other people in the way. Right? And it comes together with feelings of superiority of other people. In other words, sometimes when a person is obsessed and driven by the fire of ambition, and there's no stopping, like there's such determination, it lends itself very, very strongly and becomes very dangerous to become like a bulldozer that sort of destroys everything in its sight. In other words, the person becomes so ambitious that nothing stops them, to the point where someone else can get hurt in the process, someone else can lose out in the process, and it becomes a very egocentric, as we see very, very often, that ambitious people, very often, very ambitious people, sometimes, or very often, actually can be very ego-driven, or very egocentric. And what happens is that this very character trait, which is so essential to human development, becomes the very source of the destruction of the human being. Rather than becoming something that supports the growth of the human being, it becomes something that destroys the human being. Why? Because the point of human development is to change. The point of human development is to learn to go out of ourselves. The point of growing as a human being is to learn to share space with others, relationships, to enter other people's worlds, as we've spoken about so many times. And ambition helps us do that. Ambition gives us determination, it helps us go out of ourselves, it helps us push our comfort level. But when it becomes ego-driven, it's exactly the opposite. What it does is it actually strengthens our ego rather than letting ourselves change, rather than letting ourselves go out of ourselves. It serves to make us become more trapped within ourselves, to feel more superior to other people, to be more insecure about our own, to be more pushy about ourselves to the detriment of other people, rather than entering the world of other people, rather than sharing our space with other people, rather than changing and exploring other opportunities within other people with other experiences, we become more focused on ourselves. Which is the exact distinction between healthy jealousy and unhealthy jealousy. See, going back to those people in the desert who wanted the opportunity of bringing the paschal lamb, they didn't have a problem with other people. They just wanted it because it was something good and they wanted to share that experience. But as soon as jealousy becomes egocentric, it's more about having it and other people not having it. It's about having it to become better than other people, not to have the opportunity to learn from others. See, when the Talmud says that jealousy of the wise creates wisdom, it's about finding opportunities. Oh, I find someone that is knowledgeable in a certain area, I aspire to that. Not because I want to be better than the other person, not because I want to feel superior to the other person, not because I don't want the other person to have it, but because I want to learn from that person. I want to explore new opportunities. There's a very, very fine line. So that's why, going back to this passage the ethics of the fathers, lust, jealousy, and pursuit of glory are the critical elements that make a human being develop, and it's also the destruction of the human being, depending on how it's done. As soon as it's egocentric, as soon as it's a very fine line, as soon as it's As soon as it's ego-driven, it destroys the human being. It's all about me becoming better than other people. It's me becoming more locked within myself. Not being able to tolerate other people have things I don't have. That's unhealthy jealousy. But if it's healthy jealousy, it's about healthy ambition, then it's not about other people not having, it's not about me being superior to other people, it's about me learning and understanding the opportunities and the potential that I can learn from other experiences and other people. It's very, very, very hard to make that distinction, but it's from one extreme to the other. So one of the dangers of ambition is that it can fall into egocentric ambition where it becomes very destructive. The second danger of ambition is that it can lead to incredible frustration. How so? Because here comes a very, very important thing, and also a very, very fine line, and this is where we're going to see this relationship between these two concepts we're talking about today. On the one hand, a person needs to be ambitious. A person always needs to look for new things and new potential. But it's got to be within the context of my ability and in the context of my role and my purpose within this world. You see, the issue is as follows. And again, this is a very fine line, very difficult to achieve its balance. Every person in the world is different. We all have different roles. We all have different purpose in this world. We all have different abilities, different talents, and different journeys, different experiences. And within those experiences, within those roles, in that purpose, we have infinite potential. So the infinite potential teaches me that I've got to be so ambitious that I can overcome tremendous obstacles and grow infinitely and become so different than I am today that next week or next month or next year I should be a completely different level. But at the same time, I can only be in a completely different level within the context of my ability. To give you a very simple example, a human being has infinite potential, but someone who's tone deaf is tone deaf. They're not going to become a superstar singer. Just not going to happen. Right? It's like me trying to become a carpenter or a sculptor or an artist. I mean, I got two left hands. It's just the way I was born. Right? It would be stupid. It would be silly for me to explore that. My wife thinks it's an excuse sometimes not to change the light bulb, but no, I can do that. But everyone's different. Everyone has different experiences. And experiences create opportunities or take away certain opportunities. And therefore, it's a very, very difficult balance to achieve because, on the one hand, a person should be driven with a feeling of determination, of ambition. But sometimes that feeling of determination and ambition can then translate into a delusional expectation where I start to believe that I can achieve everything, even things that are just out of my world. Right? And therefore, together with ambition, which is so important, together with determination, there has to be that concept of humility where every person recognizes and accepts what they are. That feeling of acceptance. And that's the idea of hod. It's a completely different mindset than ambition. And they both have to be present. It's very difficult. It's a complete opposite mindset. It's a mindset of, I can accept where I am. I can accept what I am. I don't need to be different. But at the same time, within my context, I have to become very different. So it's two very different mindsets that have to coexist. There's a famous little story. I think it's a story that was told by the Baal Shem Tov. I might have shared this before, I'm not sure. He told the story of two people who passed on to the next world. And they came before the heavenly court and they were reviewed, their life was reviewed. And it was seen, it was apparent that they'd lived a very good life, both of them. Done tremendous mitzvahs and good deeds and lived a life of purpose and fulfillment. However, there was a story that came up in a review of their lifetime there was a story that had come up that had demonstrated that they had both done the wrong thing, well intended, but they had mixed up their mission. And as a result, they were sent down to this world and to be reincarnated, to live again, to fix up what they had missed in the previous life. What was the story? The story he told was as follows. It was called the story of the misguided souls. The story was that one of them was a very wealthy businessman, and the other was what we call a balagola. A balagola is a wagon driver. In olden times, that was the means of transport. And businessmen would use balagolas, they would use wagon drivers to go from one city to the next to do business. And what had happened was as follows. This businessman had employed this balagola, this wagon driver, to take him on a business trip to another town in order to engage in a business deal. And what had happened was they had traveled and something had gone wrong, they had a bit of a delay. And they came to a town which was not the town of their destination, but they came to this town on Erev Shabbos, on Friday afternoon. Still a few hours left to Shabbos, but they realized that if they continued traveling to the next town, which was the town of the destination, they would get there in the middle of Shabbos. They didn't want to travel on Shabbos, so therefore they had no choice and they decided they would have to stop in this previous town and spend Shabbos there. And then at the end of Shabbos, they would be able to continue traveling and go on to their town. Okay. So they settled into a hotel, they parked themselves, and they each went out. There were a few hours left of the day before davening, before shul time. And they both decided that they were going to go out and look for something positive to do. They were both good people, both the businessman and the wagon driver, and they needed to look for something positive and purposeful to do. So the businessman set out and he's looking for something, he's looking for a mitzvah, maybe he can help someone. And all of a sudden in the distance, he hears screaming. Obviously someone in distress, someone who needs help, and he follows the noise, he follows the screaming. And he comes to the end of the town and he sees that there's another balagola, this is the businessman, he sees there's a wagon driver, another wagon, not his wagon driver, but another wagon driver who's got his horse and buggy stuck in the mud. And he's in distress because the horse is stuck, hanging out, the horse is in distress, the horse is in danger of becoming injured or dying, he'll lose his parnassah, he'll lose his livelihood, and this guy needs help. So in his zest and his enthusiasm to help another Jew, this rich businessman says, "Let me help you out." And he starts to pull out the horse and the wagon out of the mud together with this wagon driver. The problem, of course, was that this businessman had never touched a horse, never mind pulled one out of the mud. He had no idea what he was doing. It wasn't his field. His field was business. He employed wagon drivers. He'd never, ever had anything to do with horses and wagons. He didn't know how they work. He didn't know what motivates them, what doesn't motivate them. Anyway, he tried schlepping, he tried helping. The horse got agitated, he kicked him, he injured him. He got full of mud, his clothes got ripped. And after about an hour or two, the horse was still in the mud, the horse was still in trouble. This guy was completely, as they say in Yiddish, tzahakt. And he went off to his hotel and to start Shabbos, and he was in a complete mess. That was his story. At the same time, what was his wagon driver doing? His wagon driver also wanted to do something positive. He wanted to do a mitzvah as well. So what does he do? He goes to the local shul. Now, in olden times, in the shtetlach, there was a practice that used to go like this. That if poor people who were in need of a meal, of a charity, and they wanted to be invited out for Shabbos, they would go to the local shul. And they'd wait for people in the city to come and invite them for a Shabbos meal. And that's how it used to happen. There was a guy in charge that on a Friday night meal, a Friday night service, after davening, he would ensure that all the poor people were invited out to people who could afford to give them a meal, and you know the gabba, the shamas would make sure before he goes on that everyone was taken care of. So this wagon driver, he goes to the shul early, because he wants to do a mitzvah. So what does he do? He goes to the shul and he sees a whole bunch of beggars there, a whole bunch of poor people who look like they haven't eaten in a few days, but they're starving and they need a meal. And he's got this enthusiasm, he wants to do chesed, he wants to do good tzedakah, he wants to feed people. So he invites them all to his hotel room for Shabbos. By the time the shamas comes to shul, after davening, he looks around to see if everyone's taken care of. This was an easy Friday night, everyone's taken care of, everyone's already invited, because they're all invited by this wagon driver who came to shul early. The problem, of course, was that this wagon driver didn't have much himself. Right? He was a poor wagon driver, that's what he was. He didn't have much, he was a balagola, he didn't have much himself. So he invites all these guys to his hotel room. He gives them kiddush and a bit of challah and a bit of fish, but these guys haven't eaten in 3 days, right? So they're all sitting there by a Shabbos table in his hotel room, and they go away and they're all hungry. So in the heavenly court, they looked at these two people and says, look, both of you guys were very enthusiastic. Both of you guys were looking for something good to do. Both of you guys were looking for something positive, a positive experience. But you were both misguided. You both chose the mitzvah that wasn't your mitzvah. You, the businessman, had no business even attempting to get the horse out of the way. It wasn't your thing. You knew you couldn't do it. It's not your field. It's not your area of expertise. It's a nice thing. It's a nice mitzvah. You want to get help. Go and find someone to help you. Not help yourself. You're well-intended, but misguided. And the same thing with the balagola, the wagon driver. You went to shul. You wanted to do chesed. You wanted to give charity. But you didn't have what to feed these guys. So you were so enthusiastic, but you took them and they went away hungry. So the Baal Shem Tov used to tell the story as an example of this idea that we have to always look for new things. We have to always look for new levels. We have to grow. But everyone is different. Everyone has different experiences. Everyone has different areas of expertise. People need to look for growth, but in the growth in their area. And people need to understand and learn to accept what they are. If it's not something I can do, it's not something I can do. I need to accept that. But, yeah. Correct. No, so that's what I'm saying. So therefore, in relationships...
Where does the acceptance stop? Or where does
the
acceptance open and change?
So this is a very, very, very... Yes, a very important question.
But how do you accomplish
that? See, where does ambition stop and acceptance kick in? That's a very difficult question. And one needs a lot of thought. One needs a lot of... Normally, the truth is that can really not, if one has a problem with this fine line, normally one cannot actually come to the conclusion on one's own. One actually needs an objective piece of advice, because it's so hard to know if I don't want to do something, is it because I can't, or is it because I don't want to? Right? And very often it's because I don't want to. Not because I can't, I could. But there are areas where I can't, and there are areas where I need to accept myself. And that's a very, very fine line. It's very difficult to know. And that's why a person has to work on integrating both of these mindsets, where we don't have only ambition or only acceptance. We've got to have both. Then the challenge is, how do we marry them together, and what's the dose of each one? It's a very difficult thing. You're right. It's a very, very... This is one of the most complicated areas of human development. To actually know why I don't want to do something. Is it because I really can't? I just have to accept it? Or is it because I don't want to? I really could do it. If I was... Yeah, but sometimes you have the opposite problem. You see, if you're very, very motivated, it could be misguided motivation. Like the poor man, like the wagon driver. He was very motivated, but he was misguided motivation. Because the thing was the opposite around. He had too much ambition, but he didn't have the acceptance. Right? So, very often we've got too much acceptance, very often we've got too much ambition. And it's getting a healthy dose of each, which is the real challenge.
Isn't it also about knowing where to throw your energy? Like, certain battles.
Correct, but it's a question of knowing which one, you see. Yeah, there's no question like this. There's no question that every person has infinite potential. Right, let's emphasize that. Every person could change. That there's no human being that exists that cannot change and cannot explore new opportunities and new experiences. It's just a question of which ones they are, that's all. Right? So, one thing for sure, acceptance can never be to the exclusion of any growth. Then it's misguided, for sure. Because everyone has infinite potential. Everyone has an opportunity to do things differently, to go out of their comfort zone, to explore new heights. But it's a question of where you're right. It's a question of where... And everyone has the ability to invest tremendous energy in that growth. But it's a matter of learning where to invest that. And it's very... And we saw... There's an expression in the Talmud, Adam Karov Etzel Atzmo, which means a person is related to himself. What that means is, in other words, we're all biased when it comes to ourselves. No one is really able to properly assess themselves. And that's why, you know, we've said it so many times, that's why in Pirkei Avot it says that it's so important for every single human being to have a mentor and to have a friend, a true friend, because you have to have objective assessment. No one can really, truly assess themselves, because we don't know ourselves. Much as we think we do, we really don't. And if we left it only to ourselves, we inevitably will be misguided. We'll either misplace our ambition or misplace our acceptance, depending on what we like. There's a famous saying. There was a great Hasidic Rebbe called Reb Zusha of Anipoli. See, this is the flip side of what I said before. Like, on the one hand, we said before that a person has to say, when will my actions reach the actions of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob? At the same time, Reb Zusha of Anipoli said, he should say the following. He says that when he reaches 120, he used to say, and he gets upstairs, he's not worried, he said. This is what he used to say. He said he's not worried of them asking him, Zusha, why weren't you like Moses? Because I'm not Moses. Or Zusha, why weren't you like Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob? Because I'm not them. He says, what I am worried about is, I'm worried about them turning around and asking me, Zusha, why weren't you like Zusha? Right, that's what I'm worried about. Why didn't you reach the potential that was possible for Zusha to reach? Right? You see, that's the balance here. There's a beautiful thought, I'll just end with this. There's a beautiful thought that I read a few weeks ago. From another great Hasidic leader called the Mor V'Shamash. And it was a parsha of the week a few weeks ago where we read a very interesting thing. It was about how the Jews camped in the desert when they left Egypt. So there's a whole long description in Torah about how they should camp, how there was four groups and each group had their designated space, and what you had is you had the sanctuary in the middle, and then you had four groups of the tribe of Levi, the Levites, and around those four groups you had four groups of Jews. Each group was made of three tribes, and each tribe had a banner and a symbol, and it was a very organized structure of how the Jews traveled in the desert. And there's a fascinating midrash that says, why did this come about? How did it happen that the Jews should camp in this very, very prescribed and specific structure? And the Midrash says that what happened was that when God gave the Torah, He revealed Himself at Mount Sinai. There was a divine revelation. And we read that when God revealed Himself at Mount Sinai, He revealed Himself together with thousands and tens of thousands of angels. And these angels came in also a very specific, particular formation. The Jews saw this concept of God in the middle, so to speak. And around Him was specific groups of angels led by different angels, and each group had its specific space and specific culture, so to speak. And the Jews saw this, and the Midrash says that they suddenly, when they witnessed this, they had this burning desire to camp in the desert using the same formation and the formula as the angels. And they really wanted, they saw it was so beautiful that they wanted to camp in exactly the same way. And the Midrash says that God granted their request, and therefore He gave instructions for them to be divided up into these small four groups, and around the four groups, larger four groups, and all things. So this Hasidic Rebbe, this Mor V'Shamash, is called, asks the question, he says, what was so beautiful about how the angels revealed themselves? Well, okay, so they came in groups, so they were very nicely organized. What was so amazing? What did the Jews see that was so deep that gave them this burning desire to camp in exactly the same way? And he says a very beautiful thought. He said, it's not just the geography of it that they saw. It's not just that they saw that there was different groups of angels, and therefore they wanted to also be different groups. What they saw was something very deep. They saw that there were different groups of angels, and each group represented a different concept, a different idea. In fact, Kabbalistically we know that there groups of angels who represent the power of love, others represent the power of fear, chesed, gevurah, etc. And what they saw is that each group of angels were happy in their own group. No one tried to infringe on someone else's group. No one tried to intrude on someone else's space. Each one kept within their mission, within their role, within the concept that they represented. And they saw that amazing ability. And that's what the Jews desired. That's what they said. Maybe we can also camp that way. In other words, we can also learn to appreciate that we each have a role, we each have a mission. Just like a human body, where there's a foot and there's a head, and each, right? The foot is a critical part. The head is a critical part of the body. If one wants to become the other, it doesn't work. Right? Symbolically, if the foot want to become a head, if the head want to become a foot, it wouldn't work. So that's what they saw. That's what was so amazing. So that's that balance. That on the one hand, there's this beautiful concept of humility. Humility means accepting what I am, accepting my experiences in life, accepting my mission, accepting my talents, accepting the level of talent that God gave me. Not desiring to become, accepting that with the way I was created is the best way for me to fulfill my mission, my purpose. But at the same time, to have the mindset of ambition to, within my context, within my group, within my set of talents and abilities, to be able to grow infinitely with infinite potential. And the only way that that's possible, as I said, is a very, very complicated process of marrying together both mindsets, both the male aspect and the female aspect, both the concept of ambition, always moving forward, always creating something new, and at the same time the concept of humility to stay where I am and to accept where I am. When those two things can work both, when we can develop and learn to have both those mindsets simultaneously, the mindset of ambition and the mindset of humility, then we can strike the right balance and we can truly develop as human beings. But as I said before, it's not easy. And that's why normally one needs outside assessment to be able to figure out where I need to apply the mindset of ambition, where I need to apply the mindset of humility, and then they can be healthily married together. I just want to remind everyone again that next week I'm in Melbourne, so I won't be able to give the session, but we'll have one more session of this series, which will be in 2 weeks' time on the 2nd of July. And at that time, we'll also announce the new topic or the new series.
Are you going to battle with the